Welcome to Beyond the Filter, a podcast about censorship. I'm Brandy.
And I'm Jeremy.
And today we're talking to Varsha Vaishali, the founder and executive director of Cyber Harassment Support, a Canada-based nonprofit dedicated to digital dignity, cyber harassment awareness, AI fraud education, and online safety support for youth, women, seniors, families, and vulnerable communities. Welcome to the podcast, Varsha. Can you tell us a bit more about what cyber harassment support does?
Thank you, Brandy, and thank you, Jeremy, for having me on your show. My name is Varsha Vaishali, and as you said, Cyber Harassment Support, or CHS, is a Canada-based nonprofit focused on digital dignity, cyber harassment awareness, AI fraud education, and online safety support. Our work is mainly in three areas: prevention, awareness, and victim navigation. We educate communities about online harms such as cyberbullying, sex torture, impersonation, image-based abuse, doxing, online hate, scam, and AI-enabled fraud. We also help people understand practical steps when they are targeted online, how to preserve evidence, where to report, when to involve platform, police, school, employers, or legal support, and how to avoid making the situation worse in panic. CHS is not a law firm, police agency, or crisis line. We are a support navigation organization. Our goal is to help people feel less alone and more informed when they are facing online harm. That's why our slogan is empowering every voice, ending cyber silence, because every click deserves respect.
So what prompted you to establish cyber harassment support?
I started CHS, or cyber harassment support, because I saw a serious gap between online harm and practical support. I'm myself into IT industry since last 15 years, and I always believed that technology is to help people, not to exploit them. Many people experiencing cyber harassment were just told block and report. But in real life, the situation is not so simple. It's more complex. Some may be facing threats, sexual humiliation, impersonation, or professional damage. Even it leads to financial extortion or content that keeps resurfacing online. Blocking alone doesn't solve the problem. I have seen many cases personally where getting minimum requirements like education and other things had been stopped because of cyber harassment. After looking into these cases across the globe, I thought we need to educate people, empower people, and give them practical direction and support them emotionally. For me, CHS came from the belief that online harm is real harm and digital dignity should be treated as a part of human dignity.
When someone first comes to you for help, what are the most common situations you see? Stalking, image-based abuse, impersonation, threats, doxing, financial extortion, or something else?
I'll tell you some real stories that I have dealt with without naming anyone. When I started CHS, I thought I'll start focusing on Canada and then I will go global. But the first case that came from me was from Nigeria and different parts of the world, where young girls came because of image-based abuse, the sex torture or fake profiles. And that really moved me. I see many cases of sex torture, image-based abuse and profiles. I also see dogpiling, online stalking, doxing, and financial extortion. We also see many cases of harm, which is layered. For example, a person may first face emotional manipulation, then intimate image threats, and then fake accounts. A growing area in AI-related harm, fake image, clone voices, and fake accounts, and scams that look more like convincing than before. CHS also has a tool called AI Fraud Detection Tool. We have made it in the interest of public. If they have any kind of image-based abuse happening through AI, they can upload the image and check whether it's an AI-generated image or a real image. So that's an initiative that CHS has taken to help people.
So what's the first practical advice you give to someone who's panicking because abusive or intimate materials being circulated online?
The first advice that I always give victims, and also in all my webinars, is pause, take a breath, and do not act from panic. Then preserve evidences, take screenshots, save URLs, usernames, timestamps, messages. If there are any payment demands, then all the receipts of payment. Do not alter any evidence. Do not negotiate endlessly with the harasser. In sextortion or image-based abuse cases, paying money often does not stop the abuse. It may increase demand. Report the content to the platform using correct reporting category. If there are threats, sexual exploitation, minor involved, extortion or stalking, or fear of physical harm, consider connecting to police or the emergency lines immediately. Most importantly, victims should know this is not their shame. The responsibility belongs to the person abusing, threatening, or disturbing the content, or distributing the content, sorry. And to remember that, they are not alone. We are there. CHS is here to help, support, and make them navigate through all the reporting pathways.
Many victims are told simply to block and report. In your experience, when is that enough? And when does it become necessary to preserve evidence, involve police, or seek legal help?
Blocking and reporting can be enough when the situation is low risk, isolated, and there is no serious threats, no immediate care contain no doxing or stalking or no repeated escalation. I'll give you a real life example. For example, you get a friend request from on Facebook or Instagram, and you realize that this profile might be fake or they're trying to gather more information. That's a low risk scenario where there is no money involved or no threats that have yet happened. In those scenarios, if you just block it and stop from any further abuse to happen, then that should be enough. But blocking alone is not enough. Well, there is intimate image abuse, extortion, threats of violence or self-harm, manipulation, doxing, impersonation, or repeated stalking, threats to family or employment, or harassment is happening not just in one platform, but in multiple platforms. Or you see there are minors involved, or there are financial harms that's happening. In those cases, just blocking is not enough. We have to preserve the evidence and report it to police or the proper legal channel. We have to take right steps depending on the seriousness of the scenario.
So how responsive are platforms in practice when cyber harassment is reported? Are there particular gaps between what their policies promise and what victims actually experience?
Interesting question. Yes, it varies widely. Some platforms respond quickly and some clearly do violation of the policies. In my own personal experience, I have seen where victims have reported a number of times, but they haven't received the response timely. Many victims experience delays, automated response, or unclear decisions, or contain stay up despite of obvious harm. The gap is often between platform policy and lived reality. A policy may say that harassment is not allowed, but reporting processes may not understand the context, pattern, language, coded abuse, or coordinated attacks. I'll tell you one of the recent examples when somebody was a victim of dogpiling, and in spite of reporting number of times, there was no action taken. Many platforms, reputed platforms, instead of reporting fake profiles who are selling products and taking the payment, but the product never arrives and they just disappear, no action has been taken. So, of course, policy is there, but execution has to be more rapid and response has to be more rapid.
How do you help victims document abuse without forcing them to repeatedly re-experience traumatic material?
We try to make documentation structured and limited. Instead of asking the person to repeatedly explain everything, we encourage them to create simple evidence folder. Screenshots, links, username, dates, time, platform names, and short description. When possible, a trusted person can help collect and organize evidence so the victim is not constantly rereading the abusive material. We have many YouTube videos uploaded in our YouTube channel where we explain how actually you can document the evidence or take a backup of it. The key is, document is enough to support reporting or legal steps, but do not make the victim live inside the abuse again and again. So we also support the victim that there is a life ahead and you have to think in a better way and to get out of the trauma. My experience is that the victim also knows the pathways. It's just that They need someone to understand the issue and give them a direction, and somebody who listens and makes them feel empowered.
How are victims impacted by the seeming permanency of online content, where algorithms may repeatedly resurface the materials of their humiliation and abuse for years to come?
The seeming permanence of online content creates a second layer of harm. The original abuse may happen once, but the internet can make the victim feel that humiliation endlessly. Algorithms, screenshots, reposts, or search results and archives can make the person feel trapped in a version of themselves they did not consent to. This might affect their mental health, employment, relationship, education, and self-worth. Victims may stop connecting to people, speaking publicly, stop dating, withdraw from the society. This is why cyber harassment is not just online harm, it's also offline. It can shape somebody's offline life drastically. So it has to be taken very seriously, and laws and companies around it have to respond rapidly so that when such kind of contents are reported, they should be taken down immediately.
We've seen coordinated harassment campaigns aimed at getting people fired, deplatformed, or professionally destroyed. How do you advise someone whose livelihood is under attack in this way?
When somebody's livelihood is under attack, I advise them to separate three things. First is preserve evidence, see your safety, and communication. Preserving evidence is very important of the campaign, post, messages, tags, emails to your employer or anyone in your family, threats, false claims, or coordination. Second, assess your safety. Are these threats doxing or physical risk or stalking? If there is immediate life risk, then please reach out to your police station or emergency support of your area. Third, prepare a calm, factual statement for your employer, school, client, or professional contacts. Do not respond emotionally to every attacker. A short, clear, evidence-based response is usually stronger. If false allegations, defamation, threats, or employment consequences are involved, legal advice is very necessary.
What kinds of cases are hardest to get authorities or platforms to take seriously?
The hardest cases, I would say, from my experience, are often platform-based harms. One message may look small, but 200 messages over time create fear. One fake account may look minor, but repeated impersonation can destroy reputation. One joke may not look serious, but coordinated humiliation can become psychological abuse. Authorities and platforms sometimes respond better to single clear violation than ongoing patterns. That is why documentation matters. I'll tell you a funny part. Freedom of speech in democracy. Often when it comes to coordinated attacks, police and others, they say that this is not a criminal offense and we will not deal with it. And freedom, everybody has a freedom of speech. But they don't realize when this online abuse might convert to offline. Cases involving marginalized people, intimate partner abuse, anonymous accounts, cross-border perpetrators, or coded harassment can also be harder to escalate.
As you've just said, cyber harassment is sometimes dismissed as not real harm compared to physical violence. How do you make the case for its seriousness, including sometimes to law enforcement?
I explained that online harassment can create real-world consequences. And we have seen that many, many cases. Cyber harassment can lead to job loss, school avoidance, relocation, depression, anxiety, self-harm risk, family breakdowns, financial loss, and physical safety concerns. For teens going through cyberbullying and other kind of online harassment, they can avoid going to school at all. I have seen seniors, those who have stayed in a particular place for a long time, but because of stalking and financial laws, they decided to leave the country to another place to avoid cyber harassment. Also, online abuse is not always separate from offline abuse. In many domestic violence or stalking situation, becomes a tool of control. Seriousness is not measured only whether someone is physically touched. It is measured by the fear, the loss of dignity, loss of autonomy, and real life impact. And that is why I say cyber harassment is as serious as any kind of offline or physical harassment.
Cyber harassment is inherently borderless, right? So what happens when the harasser is in a different country from the victim? And how often does that effectively guarantee impunity?
Cyber harassment might not have borders, but enforcement can be done throughout the globe. When the harasser is in another country, the victim may face judicial barriers, slow cooperation or platform limitations, and uncertainty about which law applies. It does not always guarantee that justice cannot be given. When we see the GDPR, the European Union laws, and other things, when we globally come together to create right technology and right platforms, and we treat it as a global problem, then the issue can be addressed. That is why platform responsibility, international cooperation, and practical victim support is so important. For victims, the practical focus becomes evidence, platform reporting, safety planning, and local police advice, and legal guidance where possible. So it's very, very important that we think it as a global problem, we come together, different countries and different laws come together to support victims, because we never know. We can, somebody sitting in Canada may be cyber harassed for somebody sitting in Russia. So we have to take it as a global problem, cooperate with each other and support the victims.
How does Canadian law currently compare to other jurisdictions on image-based abuse and cyber harassment? Where are the biggest gaps?
Canada has laws that can apply to image-based abuse, criminal harassment, extortion, threats, non-consensual distribution of image, intimate image, privacy, and defamation. Some provinces also have civil remedies for intimate image abuse, but the gap remains. Online harm moves faster than legal system. Victims often need urgent removal, but legal remedies can take time. Cross-border enforcement remains difficult. AI-generated image, intimate images also create new challenges, because the content may be fake, but the harm is real. The biggest gap is not only law on paper, it is practical access to help, speed of response, platform accountability, and the trauma-informed processes.
How much cyberbullying of minors comes from peers in their same age group? And should that affect the way we approach the problem?
A significant amount of cyberbullying among minors comes from peers, classmates, friend groups, or former friends, or online communities. I often see children, teens going on Snapchat, talking to strangers. That should affect how we respond. Children and teens still developing judgment, empathy, impulse control, and digital awareness. Not every case should be treated only through punishment, education, school environment, parent awareness, or compassionate approach to the problem, and safety planning matters. School boards should make online safety education as mandatory education in schools. Children should be taught how to use internet responsibly. And I'm happy to share that CHS has been invited by Halton District School Board to create awareness program in the school in Halton. And we hope that this awareness campaigns will make children empower and give them the understanding of how to behave responsibly on internet. It's not only about the victim who's being abused. It's also about everybody, all children, to know how to navigate online responsibly.
Are there particular patterns of cyber harassment that disproportionately affect LGBTQ plus people compared to the general population?
Yes. LGBTQ plus people can face specific pattern. Outing threats like identity-based threats or sexualized harassment, doxing, impersonation, family or workspace exposure, and coordinated hate. For some people, online hate can create physical, family, employment, or housing risk. So the harm is not only offensive speech, it can threaten safety and belonging. Support must be identity aware and not dismiss unique risks that LGBTQ plus victims may face. So it's an inclusive problem. And cyber harassment support CHS sees everybody equally and feels that everybody has a dignity online. And we also want to create awareness among the LGBTQ plus communities so that they also feel empowered and understand not to be silenced when such kind of situations come in.
So here at the Center for Online Safety and Liberty, one of our thematic areas is fandom. And we often hear about disputes over fan fiction, shipping, age gap fiction, kink content, or other controversial fan works, which escalate into doxing, threats, employment complaints, or mass reporting campaigns. So my question to you is, at what point does disagreement within a community become cyber harassment?
Everybody has a right to disagree, but disagreement becomes harassment when it crosses from criticism of idea into targeted abuse of a person. People can criticize contain, theme, fiction, art, community norms, but it becomes harassment when there is doxing, threats, stalking, or mass reporting abuse, employment complaint made to punish someone, sexual shaming, impersonation, or attempt to destroy someone's life. The line is not, I dislike your work. The line is, I am mobilizing harm against you as a person. So we have to understand this thin line. Everybody has a right to survive and everybody has a right to dignity. And I do have right to disagree to something. But that doesn't give me the privilege to criticize someone to that extent that it becomes a problem for them to carry out their day-to-day activities.
Have you observed a shift in the way cyberbullying has manifested over time? Like, for example, is using purity culture as a justification for harassment a relatively new phenomenon?
I think online harassment has changed over time. Earlier, cyberbullying was often more direct, insults, rumors, threats. Now it can be moralized. People may justify harassment by claiming they are protecting a community, defending ethics, or enforcing purity. That makes it more dangerous because a harasser feels righteous. They may believe cruelty is acceptable because they are labeling the target as bad. But a moral disagreement does not justify doxing, threats, humiliation, or attempt to destroy someone's livelihood.
So anonymity online is often framed either as a shield for victims or as a weapon for harassers. When does it serve each role? And is there a way to preserve the former while limiting the latter?
Anonymity can protect vulnerable people like survivors, whistleblowers, activists, LGBTQ plus youth, people escaping abuse, and people in unsafe environments. But anonymity can also be used to harass, threaten, impersonate, and abuse without accountability. The challenge is not to destroy anonymity completely. The challenge is to create systems where people can speak safely while platforms can still meaningfully address abuse, repeated offenders, and coordinated attacks and serious threats. So I want to just summarize this and say that anonymity is good when it is about survivors, whistleblowers, activists, or LGBTQ plus community, or people escaping from any kind of abuse or unsafe environments. But if somebody is trying to abuse someone or impersonate someone, we should have tools to track them down and stop that abuse.
How do you distinguish between harassment that should trigger intervention and merely offensive or unpleasant speech that may not justify takedown or legal action?
Not all offensive speech should trigger takedown or legal action. The key question are, is it targeted? And if it is targeted, is it repeated? Is there a threat involved? Is there doxing? Is there intimate contempt? Is somebody trying to impersonate? Is there coordinated pile-on? Is there a power imbalance? Is there a real-life harm or fear? Is there a fear of any physical harm? A single unpleasant opinion may be a speech. A sustained campaign to intimidate, expose, threaten, or destroy someone, I call it harassment.
So what safeguards should exist to prevent harassment reporting systems from being weaponized against activists, journalists, sex workers, queer people, or unpopular speakers?
The reporting system need due process and context. Safeguards should include clear definitions, human review of complex cases, appeal mechanism, protection against mass reporting abuse, recognition of counter speech and victimism, special caution where reports targets are marginalized people, journalists, sex workers, or queer communities, or unpopular speakers. A safety system itself becomes censorship tool if it can track fairness and accountability.
How has AI changed cyber harassment, especially deepfakes, voice cloning, fake profiles, and automated pylons?
AI has made cyber harassment faster, cheaper, and more believable. We now see risks such as deepfakes, intimate images, voice cloning, fake screenshots, fake profiles, automated harassment, romance scam, impersonation, and AI-generated email for phishing, which looks very legit. The terrifying part is that the content does not have to be real to cause the real harm. A fake intimate image can still humiliate, threaten, and damage someone. AI has also increases the scale. One person can create what looks like a crowd. One fake profile can become many. One image can be altered in many forms. So with AI in picture, the harassment has increased, and so should the tools and the prevention mechanism should increase.
So how can technology be leveraged by platforms and individuals to reduce incidents of cyberbullying? For example, giving users greater capacity to filter content, or maybe using AI to detect and filter abusive messages?
Technology can help if designed carefully. Platforms can improve reporting tools, detect abusive patterns, limit repeat offenders, reduce virality of harmful content, and give users strong filter and controls. AI can help detect threats, impersonation, non-consensual intimate content, and coordinated harassment. But it may now must also be used carefully, because automated system can make mistakes and may silence legit speeches. Individual can use privacy settings, keyword filter, two-factor authentication, count monitoring, reverse image search, and trusted contacts. The goal is not only removal, it is to prevent and to use control. So it's more about creating technology which is responsible, which can help people increase their productivity in their day-to-day life rather than silencing them. So we have to work together and implement these small steps that, as I said, two-factor authentication and do reverse image search whenever you feel that something is off, and have only trusted contacts.
Do you think of cyber harassment as primarily a technology problem, a legal problem, or a cultural problem? And does that framing affect how you approach solutions?
Actually, it is all three. It is technology problem, because platform design algorithms, anonymity, and AI can amplify harm. It is legal problem, because victims need enforcement rights, remedies, and accountability. But it is also a cultural problem, because many people still treat online cruelty as entertainment, gossip, activism, or just drama. And many people silence themselves because of the cultural pressure that what my family will think, what my church will think, what my school will think, and stay silenced. So the solution must also be layered: better law, better platform, better education, better victim support, and a culture that understands digital dignity. My framing is simple. Cyber harassment is not just a screen problem. It is a human dignity problem happening through technology.
So the structure of social media platforms have changed over time. For example, with sites like Tumblr and Twitter, we've seen a move away from community-based platforms to more tag and algorithmic-centric platforms. So instead of seeking out particular communities, users may be exposed to the opinions of a much broader range of people they didn't directly look for. And the nature of the websites like Twitter in particular also favor more succinct posts, meaning that people may strip nuance from their opinions to fit the word count. And then the reblogging and retweeting functions also mean that if you're following someone, you don't just see their opinions, you see the opinions of everyone they're sharing from. And this also means that the more outrageous opinions tend to get shared more. So ultimately, what I'm asking is, do you think the way social media platforms have, shifted in design have contributed to online disagreement and thus cyber harassment? And do you think a shift in the way these platforms are designed could help remedy the issue?
If I understand your question correctly, then my opinion is yes. I do think the design of social platforms have contributed to increase and intensity of online hate. Earlier, if someone disliked you, the harm might stay within smaller circles, a school, a workplace, a community, or a family group. But now features, as you mentioned, with platforms like Twitter, Tumblr, reposting, reblogging, quote posting, tagging, screenshots, or trending topics, and the recommendation platforms of algorithms, of course. One negative post can travel far beyond its original context. A private disagreement can become public spectacle. That is where the harm becomes bigger. Cyberbullying is no longer only about one person saying something cruel. It can become a system of amplification. People pile on, strangers join without knowing the full context. An algorithm may continue to push the content because it is generating engagement. The platform may not understand whether the engagement is healthy discussions or public humiliation. So in that sense, design itself becomes a part of the harm. When outrage, shame, mockery, or moral judgment travel faster than empathy or context, we have to question architecture we are building in. But I would not say the answer is to remove the reposting or resharing. These features also help people to build communities, raise awareness, expose injustice, organize activism, and find support. I have seen many such examples as well. The problem is not connection itself. The problem is frictionless harm. I think platforms need to move towards safety by design. That means asking, should every piece of content be instantly amplifiable? Should code positioning be used as a tool of mass humiliation? Should a victim have stronger control when they are being targeted? Should platforms be able to detect coordinated harm earlier? Should algorithms reward outrage less? In that way, the future of online safety cannot be only repost after, the future of online safety cannot be only to report the damage, but we have to take precautionary measures. By then, the victim may already, if we do it late, then by then the victim might already have lost dignity, mental peace, might be under depression. We need platforms design which is human-centric and where we understand the consequences on a human mind. So yes, I believe social platforms needs to be redesigned, not to censor disagreement, but to reduce the machinery of abuse. The goal should be digital space where people can speak, disagree, organize, express themselves without turning around human being into public entertainment. The problem is not speech alone. It is amplification architecture around speech. So platforms should understand and redesign the platform, which is human-centric, which is safety by design, and where people have the power to speak, but at the same time, nobody should be targeted.
Thank you very much. That really kind of brings the discussion into a larger, even larger context. I mean, cyber harassment is a large topic in itself, but I think now we're talking about just the design of the modern internet, and that's one of the biggest topics that are being discussed today. So thank you very much for your insights and for everything you've discussed with us today. It's been really valuable, and lots for us to think about there.
Thank you so much. And I'm really honored to be the part of your show. And hopefully the listeners have takeaways from this discussion and to remember that they are not alone. We are here to support, and we believe in empowering every voice and ending cyber silence, because every click deserves respect.
Thank you so much, Varsha. This was absolutely wonderful. And what you're doing is so important. And to our listeners, thank you for tuning in. This has been a very special session of Beyond the Filter, and we hope you'll be hearing from us again soon.
Thank you. Bye-bye for now.
Bye.